This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. In 1966, more than 10 years after the Supreme Court declared separate but equal illegal in Brown versus the Board of Education, many schools in the South were still segregated. That year, a federal case ordered specific action by local school boards to desegregate. And that was the year author Jim Grimsley's North Carolina school enrolled its first black children. Grimsley was just an 11-year-old boy growing up in Jones County. He had not many interactions with black people, but soon realized that he had more in common with African Americans than he might have imagined. In his new book, he describes the environment he was raised in and how he began to rethink his assumptions. Jim Grimsley is the author of several award-winning novels, including Winter Birds. His latest book is a memoir. It's called How I Shed My Skin, and Jim Grimsley joins us now. Jim, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us about growing up in those years in Jones County.
Jones County is a very rural county, just a couple of counties in from the beach. Pollocksville was the little village where I grew up, a village of about 400 people. The largest town in the county had 700, so as you can imagine, it was a tiny place, a place that had not changed much since settlers first arrived. Basically, the same families were still living there. The same black people who had been held there as slaves were sitting on the land. So it was a very quiet upbringing that masked a lot of animosity between the races. I guess that's the way to say it.
Animosity that may not have always been apparent as such, because you talk about not even having seen many African-American families as a young man.
Well, not having interacted with them. I saw black people all the time, but they were more or less invisible to me as people. That's the point I was trying to make. The county was about 60% black at that time, so you saw black people all the time, but you just didn't know anything about them, or you weren't supposed to know anything about them. You didn't have any kind of social interaction with a black person.
And that sense of invisibility, which is odd when you think about it, as you say, of course you saw black families and people walking all the time. They felt invisible to you. And as a young man, you wouldn't notice how peculiar that is. And that's the thing you notice.
Exactly.
Is how these things build in. So then desegregation is mandated.
Right. North Carolina, like a lot of other states, in order to resist total desegregation, total consolidation of the black and white school systems, they came up with a program called Freedom of Choice, which meant that people of any race could choose which of the two systems, school systems, they wanted to go to in any county. And of course, what that meant was a handful of black kids moved into the white schools and very few white kids moved into the black schools. So that existed for 2 years, and that was the beginning of integration in North Carolina.
Yep. Well, tell us, and what did that mean to you, and how did you first experience it?
Three black girls came to my sixth grade classroom in 1966. So this was the beginning of my association with black people. This was the first time I'd actually known or spoken to any black people on an equal level.
Maybe I could get you to read from your memoir.
Sure. This is a passage from the first day. One of the girls' names was Violet. Of my memories of that day, this moment comes to me the most clearly. I had a feeling it would be funny to call Violet a name, and I knew I was daring enough to do it. The feeling of that thought in my head is far more vivid than any other detail of the beginning of school. I'm fairly certain that this happened either on the first day of school or soon after. I knew that calling Violet a name would make the boys at the back of the room laugh. That moment inside my head rings down through the years so clearly. I was 11 years old, filled with a vague sense of purpose and ready to do my part, though for what I could not have said. The moment was clear, sunny. Mr. Vaughn, our teacher, had left us unattended for some reason, maybe to smoke a cigarette in the teacher's lounge. Our schoolroom had 15-foot ceilings that made the sound of our chatter ring, and windows that nearly reached to the top of the ceiling. The windows would have been open, maybe a breeze coming through to stir the heat. I had the impulse to speak again, and I turned to Violet, and a moment of silence fell over the classroom, into which I said the words I had been planning. "You black bitch," I said, and some of the white boys looked at me and grinned. People giggled nervously. Violet hardly even blinked. "You white cracker bitch," she said back to me without hesitation, and cocked an eyebrow and clamped her jaw together. I sat dumbfounded. There had been no likelihood in my fantasy that she could speak back. A flush came to my face. "You didn't think I'd say that, did you?" Her voice was even louder than before, and her eyes flashed with a kind of angry light. Everybody was listening. The laughter had stopped. "Black is beautiful. I love my black skin. What do you think about that?" "You are a black bitch," I said again, stupidly, blushing. Some of the white students continued to snicker, and I could tell they thought I was really brave. But the moment did not make me feel the way I had thought it would. "And you a white one," she said, folding her arms across her chest. Pretty soon after that, Mr. Vaughn returned. The moment came to an abrupt end. Violet said nothing further about what I called her. All the rest of the day, I could feel her gaze boring into my back.
Jim Grimsley reading from his memoir, How I Shed My Skin, Unlearning the Racist Lessons of a Southern Childhood. What else did you think about that, her comeback, the fact that she came back?
I was shocked, and then I recognized that something was wrong in what I had taught about. I had been taught about how black people would behave. She was not the least bit subservient. She didn't recognize what I thought of as her inferiority. Now, you have to understand I was 11, and the thoughts were not that clear in my head. But what I felt was I had been trying to make points off of her. I'd been trying to get a laugh off of her, and she was the one who embarrassed me. And that was the clearest result of that moment, that she humiliated me in front of the class instead of my doing that to her. And that let me know that there was a full-fledged human being in there, one probably bigger than I was at that age.
So that first prejudice now is upended. And yeah. Then there is the coming to know how you, and I love this phrase in here, I was ready to do my part, though for what I could not have said. The idea that you grow up internalizing the fact that there are parts to play,
right,
and this will be yours. When did it occur to you that these kinds of very subtle but very powerful influences are in play?
I became conscious of these openly when schools fully integrated by the eighth grade. There was a moment where When the two systems, school systems, the white and black school systems, were consolidated, there was a lot of the white kids fled to private schools. So suddenly the white kids who did stay in public school were in the minority. So my eighth grade class was about 2/3 black. This was an election year. It was the year Richard Nixon, Hubert Humphrey, and George Wallace were running for president. And the white kids were having a good time talking about how George Wallace was going to, you know, reestablish segregation and put black peoples back in their place, and the South would rise again and all that stuff. And by then I'd made friends with a girl named Evelyn Hall, and we were working on a bulletin board, and she looked at me and she said, "Look at what your white people, look at what your people are doing." And I just turned to her and I knew I had, there was a moment when I knew I had to make a choice, and I just said to her, "Look, those are not my people." Meaning, I don't want to be associated with that. That's not what I think. That's not how I intend to behave. So from that point forward, I was more or less conscious of taking a different path than a lot of the other. You know, I was not the only white kid who walked a better path. But from that point, I did it consciously, and I started listening.
There was also a growing consciousness of your own homosexuality.
Right, that's correct.
You had been born with hemophilia.
Yeah.
Those two things set you apart, you say, already, even in the white community. How do you think that being an other, even among the white community, affected your thoughts?
The hemophilia separated me from the other boys, and I think that was important because had I been involved in a gang of boys, I would have been probably more reluctant to step out of that group and to go my own way. Boys socialize one another pretty powerfully. The fact that I was gay isolated me not only in the school but in my family, and also gave me this feeling that I didn't quite know what was going on in the world, because everywhere around me I was seeing these examples of normative, you know, men and women together everywhere, TV. And I knew that's not the way my desires were running. And I didn't know what to make of that, because in those days you didn't hear anything about gay people. So I didn't really know. I think I read the term homosexual in Newsweek at some point when I was in my early teenage years. And that's the first time I had an inkling that there were other people like that out there. The sense of isolation I got, I think, kept me from quite buying into all the stuff that I had been taught. So it was very, which doesn't mean that I didn't get taught it, but it meant that it was very easy to let it go when I began to.
Well, I was going to say, there's two ways that you can go when you're the other among the majority. Then you can go overboard, bend over backwards to make sure that you're going to be part of that group and buy into it harder than anybody else.
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily obvious that you would have taken the course that you did.
Right. Well, I think it was the combination of the hemophilia with the being gay that actually that made it fairly easy to step away.
There's a section of the book where you talk about, again, this business of knowing one's place when you live in the South. And,
right.
and maybe I could ask you to read that section for us, if you would.
Place is hierarchy above all. This sense of Southern place and of any Southerner's given place is entwined with that other notion of attachment to the land. The Southerner was indeed expected to know his place, not simply in a geographical and mythological sense, and to accept this place and adhere to it. The Southerner had a position in the social order: white trash, slave, merchant, overseer, paddy roller, artisan, master. This functioned as a kind of temperature which moved up or down with one's fortunes or behavior. Knowing your place in the world and accepting it, paying respect to your betters and giving a good kick to those beneath you, these were and are part of the Southern order. A Southerner accepted his station in life but tried to find the means to rise above it. That same Southerner accepted the station of others in life and tried with all his might to keep them in it. The Southern world spent much of its energy deciding who was entitled to advantages and who was not, and most especially who was better than whom. The social hierarchy was complicated and endless, Southern memory long and vengeful. Violations of the Southern order, lack of respect for one's betters and their relations, brought quick retribution along with slow and thorough revenge. God never put us equal onto the earth. The very notion was absurd. God put us in a hierarchy, some better and many worse, and he gave us life so that we could discover who was the better and who was the worse. Southerners have never believed in equality, even when they have believed in some kind of democracy. The two ideas have never had much association with each other. In this I am speaking mostly of the white Southerner, though I don't doubt that black and brown Southerners share some of the same traits. The history I mean to trace here is my own white history, in which I grew up with an assigned place, one low in the Southern social order. I was raised to be a believer in the United States as a white nation, in the South as a white paradise, and in the superiority of my European descended race over all the other races of the earth. No one ever said these words to me in such clear terms, but nevertheless I learned the ideas behind these beliefs. In particular, I was raised to keep black people in their place and to see to it that they stayed there. My purpose here and now is to examine how good people perpetuated this in the raising of their children and in the living of their lives in my part of the South. Or to be more personal, my purpose here is to examine how, as a child, I learned bias against black people from the good white people around me. For there is no one else from whom I could have taken this lesson.
Jim Grimsley is the author of How I Shed My Skin. He's going to be reading Saturday at McIntyre's Books in Pittsburgh. He's with me today on The State of Things. I think what you say here about the fact that this that for Southerners, well, for all of us, for any kind of system of hierarchy, there's privilege for a privileged class. And so the trick for the privileged class is to show all of the people who are victimized is to create these subtle kind of stair steps. I mean, the genius of Jim Crow, wasn't it, was to show poor whites that they were slightly better than African-Americans to keep them pitted, that they became the bulwark against the obvious change that should have happened.
Right. The Jim Crow genius was to tell both groups that they were better than the other so they'd end up fighting about it, because poor blacks also thought that the one group that was lower than them was white trash, right? And that's a holdover from the slave system, because when the slaves thought, well, at least we're not white trash, we may be slaves, but we're not like them.
That's one kind of genius. The other kind of genius, of course, is that little girl in your class who stood up to you. And if you think about it, this is the first wave of African Americans integrating white schools, doing it by choice.
Right.
You have to assume they've come from families with a pretty good sense of themselves and a good understanding. So she apparently was ready for this, had internalized this, and had been already conscious of what it would take.
All the black kids were ready for us. The white kids, we were not prepared to any real degree by the adults around us for what was going to come. When there was preparation, it was negative. It was that you need to hate these people. You need not to associate with them. But most of a lot of the serious haters had fled to private schools. So what we were left with was, that's not true when the three girls first came to our class. The black communities in their churches prepared. That's where they decided who would integrate the schools during Freedom of Choice. That's where they decided later on when there were walkouts in high school, that's when they decided that would happen. That's when they warned their friends. Some of the white families got warned that something's going to go down at high school tomorrow. You might want to keep your kids out. So they were ready for us altogether, but we were not ready for them.
Well, Jim, I want to thank you so much for coming on this show and sharing your story with us.
Thank you very much.
Jim Grimsley is the author of several award-winning novels, including Winter Birds. His latest book is a memoir, How I Shed My Skin. Jim's in town this week for two events, one tonight at the Center for Documentary Studies. That's in Durham at 7 o'clock. Then he'll read this Saturday in Pittsburgh's McIntyre Books. And if you missed any of that, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org, to find out more and to get details about everything we've talked about on the show today, which was produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director, Andrew Tai, the intern. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.